The Book of Equanimity, Case 83, Preface to the Assembly. The whole body is ill. Vimalakirti is hard to cure. This grass is the medicine, and Manjushri uses it well. Isn't it wonderful to encounter and grasp a man facing the ultimate and obtain this place of peaceful ease? The main case. Attention. Guishan asked Dawu, "Where have you been?" Dawu said, "I've been caring for the sick." Guishan said, "How many people were sick?" Dawu replied, "Some are sick, some are not sick." Guishan said, "Isn't it you who's not sick?" Dawu responded, "Sickness and non-sickness have nothing at all to do with it. Speak quickly, speak quickly." Guishan said, "Even being able to say it misses it entirely." Hongzhi's appreciatory verse. Marvelous medicines never touched his lips. A divine doctor never had to take his pulse. Seeming to exist, he's not nothing. Being utterly empty, he's not something. Unextinguished, he's born. Undestroyed, he lives. He even goes utterly before the ancient Buddhas and walks alone among the empty kalpas. Being still, heaven covers, earth supports. Being active, the crow flies, the rabbit runs. Here's my disclaimer at the beginning of my Dharma talk. This Dharma talk will miss it entirely. That disclaimer is unspoken at the beginning of every Dharma talk I give, but I thought I'd speak it this time. So let's pause a minute with this preface. Vimalakirti is hard to cure. The whole body is ill. Vimalakirti is hard to cure. When Vimalakirti was sick, nobody wanted to go. None of the Buddha's Sangha members wanted to go and check in on him. Because they were afraid of Vimalakirti is brandishing the sword of non-dual wisdom. They kept on losing their heads. Buddha is very clear to his monks that caring for each other, caring for sick Sangha members, is an important responsibility. So I said, somebody needs to go. And Manjushri, the bodhisattva of non-dual wisdom, was kind of cowering back in the corner. Eventually said, "Okay, I'll go." Vimalakirti's whole body is ill. Any sickness anywhere is mine. It is also the case that any joy anywhere is mine. This is the essence of the Brahma Vihara of sympathetic joy. but here we're looking at sympathetic, inclusive suffering, illness. Yun Men says, medicine and sickness heal each other. Medicine and sickness mutually correspond. The whole world is medicine. Where will you find yourself? The whole world is medicine. The grass is medicine. And Manjushri uses it well. Mutually corresponding. Manjushri's medicine of grass mutually corresponds to Vimalakirti's all-encompassing sickness. And let's look, as James pointed us last night, to Dao Wu's first response here. Guishan says, where have you been? And Dao Wu says, I've been caring for the sick. There are sick. There are those who are sick. This world is suffering. It needs our care. It is our responsibility to care for sick Sangha members, sick Sangha members of our shared Sangha of humanity, Sangha members of our shared Sangha of beings on this small planet. They are sick. We are sick. And care is required. And as James alluded to last night, caring for the sick, tending the sick, being tender toward and tender with sickness is not the same as fixing it, curing it, making it go away. This may not be possible, that latter thing. Suffering, sickness, aging, dying, loss, change. These are marks of existence. They are not defects in the universe. They are not defects in ourselves. Dying is not failing. Dying is fully included. Even so, care for the sick. Tend to the sick. Tend to this moment. And be very clear that this tending without fixing, or this tending even as an inability to fix, also arises. This is not nothing. This is not irrelevant. This is not helpful. This is kanzeon. caring is kanzeon. Acceptance is kanzeon. Grief is kanzeon. Hurting is kanzeon. Not dispensable, not irrelevant. One person I was encountering in a capacity as a counselor has struggled with many varieties of distress her entire life. And has yielded little benefit from copious myriad forms of treatment over vast spans of time. And I was feeling overwhelmed at my own failure, my own inability, my own powerlessness in the face of this suffering that I was seeing so vividly right in front of me. And in a moment of despairing, powerless honesty, mustering every piece of Dharma awareness I could, I said to her, "You may not be fixable. And she was so relieved. She felt so seen in that moment. No one had ever said that to her. But bearing witness, keeping company with, this is very important. Caring for the sick, even as we aren't curing." And in a way, the place that one of the things that she taught me was one of the least satisfying Zen superpowers, which was that I was the thing that I could do was be able to be with my own distress at her distress, my own feelings of powerlessness, my own feelings of inadequacy. And not react by pushing her away or telling her that she must be doing something wrong because she's not making me feel like a good helper. My superpower is to be able to hurt more. And this is actually worth having. Unlike one of the other superpowers that we explored a few sessions ago, which is the power to die at will. Less useful. More of a kind of one-shot thing. But but bearing enormous distress, especially in the face and amid enormous distress, is not nothing. Care for the sick, tend to the sick. Care for this world, care for all the beings we share it with. Care for the sentient beings in my own mind who are numberless and sick. Care for them. How many people were sick? Yisan asked. Dawu replied, some are sick, some are not sick. And I appreciate the simple, complex clarity that Dawu was pointing to. Some are sick, some are not sick. Some of the sick are not sick. Some of the not sick are sick. Some of the sick are sick. Some are sick, some are not sick. Dawu seems perhaps to specialize in this capacity of heart that allows for multiple truths to not cancel each other out. Multiple truths to not have to be chosen between. Multiple truths to not have to be chosen between. In another koan, we meet Dawu, and someone raps on a coffin there in the process of burying and says to Dawu, alive or dead? Dawu says, I can't say. I won't say. And later, this monk says to Dawu, your reverence, I will hit you if you don't answer, alive or dead. Dawu says, I won't say, I won't say. You may hit me, but I can't say. Dawu is really modeling for us holding our heart open to the irresoluble quiet, the irresolvable tension between form and emptiness, between suffering and liberation, between life and death, sick and not sick. There are sick and not sick. And how many are sick? I won't say. I won't say. And part of what we are doing with our Zen practice, part of what we are doing on Sesshin, and this is what Melissa pointed to in her opening night remarks, part of what we're doing is grounding ourselves in the okayness, the all-inclusive okayness. The whole world is medicineness. We are touching in on this, familiarizing ourselves with this, enlarging our heart to this, so that we are better able to exercise our superpower of caring for the sick, doing what we can, when we can, in the amount we can, even though it will not be enough. even Buddha did not cause all wars to cease. Even Buddha did not cause all societal conflicts to cease. Even Buddha did not cure the fact of sickness, aging, and death. But he cared for the sick. And so we're here. And Buddha's failure is not nothing. I'm so grateful. Guishan pursued, isn't it you who's not sick? And a couple koans later in the Book of Equanimity is the case we looked at, I think, last summer. Dongshan is sick. And someone says to Dongshan, does the one who is not sick care for you? And Dongshan says, actually, I'm grateful to be able to care for that one. Isn't it you who's not sick? This is true. This is true. This is what we are touching into. And we cannot, we must not stay there. We must not let it be enough that I actually am fine. It's no small thing to recognize that amid all of this pain, all of this distress, all of my hurting and my big mess of a mind, I actually am fine. That's no small thing. And it took me decades to even begin to entertain might actually be true. But it cannot stop there. Because the whole world is sick. And that one there is sick. I was reflecting on Issa's poem. It's in our sutra book. The world of dew is indeed the world of dew. And yet, we could also hear this as the world of sickness is indeed sick. And yet, we could also hear this as the world of wholeness is indeed whole. And yet, how many are sick? I won't say. Isn't it you who's not sick? I won't say. And caring and caring and tending and grieving and responding. Touching sickness and wholeness, wholeness and sickness, and meeting this world as Kanzeon, meeting the world of Kanzeon, meeting the world as Kanzeon, meeting Kanzeon as Kanzeon. Just this. Again and again. Just this once. So So please sit comfortably. Be invited to come forth with Dharma dialogue, resonances, questions, comments, and the ones charged with responding for this dialogue will be myself and David and Dharma holder Kate.
So I really appreciate the way you started by invoking the contest between the great non-dualistic Bodhisattva Vimalakirti and lay Bodhisattva and Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of non-dualistic wisdom, and then, you know, took us back to this place that sounds so dualistic. Some are sick, some are not sick, but having prepared us, you know, I could hear all of the play with that and the ways that the opposition started to get less dual, less absolute. And my response as I'm listening is to think not some are sick and some are not sick, but sometimes I'm sick and sometimes I'm not sick. And also, right now, some of me is sick, and right now, some of me is not sick. And so the question is, can the one of perfect health ever tend to the sick? What's the question? Can the one who feels, who claims to be in perfect health, ever tend to the sick?
And who is that one?
So, right, isn't it?
Where is...
Yeah. I've met doctors who thought they were that one. I didn't trust them.
Yeah. Go ahead, Josh. I was just going to say, I appreciate the, you know, honoring the two and the one. I mean, that's the whole, the form and the emptiness. And provisionally we say, and it's important, as Josh was saying, to say, to honor wholeness. No problem. And important to honor separation. No problem. But anyone we take on with any kind of clinging is a problem. Of course, and I hear you sort of pointing, we take on one and then take on the next, and it's not that there's no self, it's just there's no fixed self. So no problem to appear as the one who is tending, the one who remembers. Only a problem if we get stuck there.
And one way, the one who is not sick cares for the one who's sick. Mike.
When you were talking about Manjushri being, and all the other silent, the silent members being weighed, one thing I appreciate about that question is that, Bodhisattvas can be afraid.
Yeah!
And this is the way of being Bodhisattvas.
Right.
And, you know, there are some things in my own life where I just, you know, I have some ways of recognizing suffering that I know I can't fix it, but I'm okay with being with it. But then there are things that seem like there should be a way to fix it. And I'm afraid to get my head cut off by stepping in. And because I don't know how to fix it, or I don't know what fixing it looks like. I've also been thinking about Vimalakirti, who's so sick, so taking on the sickness of the world, all he's doing, able to do is sort of lie there. And yet, just lying there, he's calling the rest of the Sangha to come and
Yeah. what generous teaching he's engaged in. Yeah, and Manjushri in the koans is an interesting character because he's often a clown and a buffoon and the one getting his head cut off and his ass kicked. And he is stepping into even that from the place of non-duality.
And some of the versions of the story are that Vimalakirti was pretending to be sick, and people would come to visit them, and he would teach them, and they would have a great awakening. But most of the bodhisattvas did not want to go in because they were afraid. And I love you naming, and all of us claiming, yes, as bodhisattvas, being terrified is one of the places we go.
And to go there as bodhisattvas.
I really like the story you told about the woman that you were trying to help who couldn't be fixed. And I've noticed in taking care of my father that in a way you offer wholeness by accepting whatever's there. So it may, you know, when you're 95, there are a lot of things that are not fixable. But you can either kind of push that away, or just say, yeah, he's perfectly whole, without hearing and not being able to see well. He's still perfectly whole, and somehow you can convey that, in the same way as you conveyed, well, I'm afraid you're just not fixable. But you're still whole. All those parts are still important, and I accept them all. There's a sort of feeling like that.
Nicely expressed. Thank you, Karen.
So, also about your story about talking with that woman, it reminded me of another Zen story I was reading in the Hidden Lamp recently, with the stories and commentaries, and it's about Buddha meeting a woman named Pratta something Puri or whatever. She loses all of her family in one day, like her kids drown and her husband gets run over by a horse and all the rest of this. And according to at least this story they're telling, that she goes crazy, she's brought before the Buddha, and the first thing he says to her is, I can't help you. And then he says, you cried oceans of tears over many lifetimes. I was thinking about, you know, what would it be like to be met, to know that you're just carrying more grief than one lifetime can hold? And then she goes on to ordain, and the story goes on. But that was, this struck me as the first thing. I can't help you. Wow, the Buddha says that.
Well, and the wonderful freedom of, I mean, as you told the story, Josh, I thought, you know, of course, we're all that woman. And such a relief that we, all of you are not fixable, none of you. And that changes the possibility, because there's some way we think, if I do Zazen enough, then I will be fixed. So this the great generosity of you, there's no hope for you.
Well, and the fear is, behind that is that that leads to a place of despair, right? That can't be fixed, then it's hopeless and dark, and you know, that's a dark path. I think it's the bodhisattvas feeling afraid of that place and yet stepping in. The task that we all have to accept even the possibility of despair, it may turn out that that's not what's really there. But we don't know until we actually step into it. First step for the Buddha to say, I can't fix you. And next step to, nevertheless, make that one's life.
Yeah. And I want to... I didn't say, yeah, I can't fix you. It was actually really excruciating for me. And it was terrifying for me to walk into that place of despair and powerlessness. And then I was just so stunned by her response of, thank you for being honest with me for the first time ever in my life. But I so wanted to be so much more helpful than I could get at all. It was crushing.
I just want to speak to that place, because the one who tends, the one who tries to help the sick. I mean, so often in my life, so often right here on the cushion, I feel like I've got nothing. I am the worst Zen student. I'm the worst husband. I'm just completely drained. And yet, what I realize when I'm watching other people is that all we have to do is show up for each other. You showed up for this person. You show just walking in the kinhin line is tending to everybody else here. And sometimes it's so, I lose sight of that completely and think there's nothing here for anybody, when of course just showing up is huge.
And this is what Vimalakirti did, right? Yeah. He showed up as, I am sick.
Yeah.
And out of that, his teaching.
Carolyn.
This is a very, very personal note for me to clarify some things. I mean, my mother died in the spring, and it was, she was almost 98, so it wasn't unexpected, but nothing sharply happened. It was just a slow decline. And one of her friends told me she was dying, and I didn't believe it. She didn't have any symptoms. Nothing seemed a lot different. And then I realized that people were pulling away from her. Friends who had visited before, her favorite nephews, even her beloved doctor who had made house calls for 10 years and was very involved, were not showing up. And that really began to worry me. And when I would try to find out what was going on, one of my cousins admitted, he said, it's too hard to be with him. I just can't do it. And then thank God for hospice, who are the bodhisattvas of the world. They don't feel like they failed if they can't cheer her up or distract her or do something to make it nice. They just feel their job is to be there and to make it easier for everyone to just be with that and not have to fix anything. It was really powerful. But it does help me to understand why some people who really love her just have very hard time not being able to do anything.
I've observed before that I feel like as my practice of Zen has progressed, I've been experiencing more anxiety. And the reason for this is that I am no longer prioritizing avoiding anxiety as the thing that's most important to me. And in the same way, the thing, if we come to Zen because we want to have less pain, right? And what we get is actually an increased capacity to be with more pain and to not have to pull away when it is our powerlessness and grief and pain that is foremost in our, that avoiding our feelings of powerlessness is not the most important thing, but actually caring for this being matters more to me.
But, and I think of the vow we all take every time the bell rings. This vow that even though that as we sit, the highest priority is not feeling comfortable. Right? We have prioritized something more, some strange pursuit of awakening. And for that time, as best we can, we say, I will not leave the room. And we go through these places where we're sure it's just hopeless, stupid. Why? I have nothing. But I think it's only when we call ourselves out together, we make this vow together, that we find the courage to go through that door. And going through the door doesn't mean doing anything. It's not like, oh, I'll do the right thing and then I'll get through the door. The only door is dying. When the person you thought you were is no longer enough. You do not have the resources to live. They are given to you. They are right here. They are free. You have already shown up. I just forgot that I'm here. Oh, here I am. Here we are. So the gift we give each other with our courage of staying in the room, whatever the weather. And then, as Carol said, that there's something that can shift. The terrible place is not what we thought it was. That the wholeness is not separate from the anxiety, that not separate from the sickness. Right? We think, oh, well, just if the healthy one fixes the sick one in me, then I'll be... No, it's not like that. And when we see that, that's the medicine. And then suddenly, whole with no hearing, a whole with no resources, a whole just as we are.
Joanne?
I really appreciate all the expressions of sharing how excruciating things can be. And a common thing for me historically and even now is like deferring to establishments. And I really appreciate hearing about this, you know, this text that we're using, that things we're sharing about. It kind of cuts through establishment in an interesting way, in a true way of, it's just a facade. You know, systems that are set up and, we're supposed to let people do things. And when you have to cross that line, kind of, and cross paths with establishments, and when you're trying to care, when you're tending, for me, it's really excruciating. And, you know, my, lifetimes of greed, anger, and ignorance. And when I think of those people not wanting to go into Manjushri, is that who it was? And like, I see, it helps me hearing this and hearing everyone, you know, that anything that goes on in any establishment, big or small, is just a dharma. And it's like I can take refuge in that. There's nothing separate. I for some reason I separate things, you know, I'll come into Dokusan. I gotta integrate. I can't integrate. Like, what, you know.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're pointing to. This is something really important. And so standing up to the establishments and also standing up to the inner establishments. These stories of historically what we're sure we are. And I also really appreciate your naming the excruciation of taking care. Taking care inner and outer. This is excruciating. And part of what our bodhisattva vow is saying, you know what? Yes, I am in for excruciating. Thank you, Joanne.
Can I say a word about excruciating too? It's been for me and my experience, the most excruciating part is when I'm hoping that things will turn out in a particular way. Right? I've got an aim, and I'm trying to manage everything so that it goes in that direction. And that in itself is an excruciating process, right? Trying to juggle all the balls and keep them going. And sometimes we do it, but when we don't, then that too feels excruciating. It's a personal failure, right? I can't do it. What's wrong with me? I can't do this. Or what's wrong with that it doesn't fall into line? If we can maybe step back just one step and just do the thing that we can do, not knowing how it's going to turn out, I think that's as much as we can ever hope to give. And that feels, to me, a little less excruciating.
Steve.
Thank you, Josh. I was really struck by how brave this was of you to say, you know, to this woman from a genuine place of, you know, I may not be able to help you with this. There may not be any way to fix this. Having, you know, faced chronic illness myself for most of my life, actually, and having to, you know, give up one thing after another that, you know, were some of my favorite things, you know, mm-hmm. and had to be given up. And the despair of not accepting that as the reality. This, you know, birth and death. This, you know, we participate both in gain and joy, and also in loss and death. And fully participating in loss is such an important thing, but you know, people when they come to a sick person, my experience is that they're trying to, you know, cheer you up. You know, you really should be cheerful. You know, you know don't feel that way. You know, you don't have to accept this. You know, fight against it. You know, let's go. Let's do something. And it's so. Difficult to face that, being from the person who is sick, right. to face people saying, you know, you really, and this, you know, accepting the fact that, so you're never going to go skiing again. You are never going to ride your bicycle again. You are never going to, whatever it is, you know, to let go of that and say, you know, okay, so, you know, what can I do from here? You know, here I am, sick in bed. You know, what can I do from this place? And that acceptance, I think, is quite an antidote for this despair of not accepting.
Right.
And yet, it strikes me as quite a brave thing to say that to someone, you know.
Yeah. And the thing that the thing that let me do that is being willing to not need to push away this very uncomfortable feeling of powerlessness. Right? So it isn't like I'm going to be brave. It's just, it's like I am going to just hurt. Yeah. But what you're pointing to is one of the thing that's described as the greatest gift of the Dharma is the gift of non-fear. And this is the non-fear that Mike was pointing to and that you're pointing to, and this is the non-fear that allows even terror. And even terror doesn't seduce us into, doesn't always seduce us into trying to fix it. Thank you, everyone.